Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. Catherine Cronin in this episode. Catherine is an early practitioner of online education, having started teaching with the Cozy Conferencing platform in the late 1990s. Her work now as an independent scholar based in Ireland emphasizes open educational practices and advocacy for equitable opportunity. This podcast is sponsored by the International Council for Open and Distance Education, ICDE, the leading global membership organization working towards bringing inclusive, quality education to all. By joining the ICDE global network of flexible and distance learning, you can help transform the world through inclusive education. Become a member or find out more by visiting www.icde.org. It's my privilege to be talking to Dr. Catherine Cronin, who's an independent scholar and critical advocate of open education based in Ireland. Her work focuses on critical and social justice approaches in digital, open, and higher education, including most recently co-editing Higher Education for Good, Teaching and Learning Futures with Professor Laura Chernowich. It is wonderful to be talking with you, Catherine.
I'm delighted to join you today. Thank you.
Great. Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
Yes, it is varied, I suppose, in one word. I have original qualifications in engineering, in mechanical engineering and systems engineering, and I followed that with an MA in women's studies. And I guess that is a theme across my career, that I'm interested in difference, in crossing borders, in how power operates. And I can describe that in many ways as a woman in engineering, as someone who's from New York City, living in the west of Ireland, combining engineering and women's studies, working in higher education and community education. But it is a thread that goes through a lot of my work. I first taught online in the mid-1990s, actually.
Wow.
I was teaching with the Open University in Scotland, and there was a course called Social and Technical Issues in Information Technology. And it was, I believe it was the first course at the Open University that used online conferencing, as it was called then. It was the COSY system. Yeah. And then a decade later, I was working as the coordinator of the first fully online program at the University of Galway here in Ireland. And from there, as you said, open education has been an increasingly important part of my work, I'd say for the past 20 years.
So pre-millennium was your first instance of online education, mine too. I think it dates us both. You would have seen a lot of change take place over that, it's almost 30-year period, isn't it?
Absolutely.
What strikes you as being different between the mid-90s to now in terms of online education, how it's done, the sorts of things you see happening?
Yeah, I mean, there have been so many waves of change in that time, haven't there? So, it was a strange thing to ask someone, literally in those Open University days, we were shipping PCs to people's homes that didn't have them before and dial-up modems and all of that. But I suppose maybe in the last 20 years, teaching online, it would have been considered outside the norm early on to use social media, to use open online spaces for teaching. Higher education institutions were more comfortable with bounded online spaces, VLEs, LMSs, and so on. Those first early MOOCs, in Canada and the follow-ons from those, the increasing use of social media was a sense of smudging the boundaries, I often used to describe it, of higher education, inviting people to, inviting students in particular to bring in their interests and to create work for communities that were important to them, by creating work that they could share openly. And then we go forward a few years now in the 2020s, and now we're increasingly talking about information abundance and overwhelm and how can we deal with that? So as I said, it's been many, many waves and generations of having to adapt. And I suppose that's the key.
So back in those days too, in the mid to late 90s with COSY, there was a different way of teaching. So the Open University would typically send materials out. There would often be television lectures, presentations, no mm-hmm. real connection with the learner. What was your teaching like back then? What did COSY release in terms of your ability to teach at a distance?
I would say that it was tentative. I remember I was teaching a couple of different classes, and the other class, which was Issues in Women's Studies, was purely the traditional OU model, correspondence tuition, you know, asynchronous writing and sending assignments, and then writing and sending feedback with occasional in-person tutorials. The issues in information technology, there were some students who really grasped it enthusiastically and used those tools, and others who absolutely never used them, wanted to study what they meant, but were really not comfortable with using them. And that really characterized, I think, a lot of those early years in the 1990s, that it was the few who used them. So, yeah. Of course, as a person who was teaching, it was trying to span that breadth, you know, and include everyone. Again, a theme, you know, in online learning continually.
Mm-hmm. So there's also been over 25 years of scholarship. So can you talk about some of the ideas and themes your work has provided that you sense are particularly pertinent today?
Yeah, I mean, so much of it has been around digital and open education and what that means in terms of not just being online together, but sound foundations of, you know, what is community, what is learning design. I found recently a presentation I had given at a conference, an EdTech conference here in Ireland in 2010, I think. And I said that the three things that characterized my teaching then were student voice, student choice, and digital literacies. So it was kind of early days of digital literacies. But, you know, at that stage, you know, I was teaching openly and giving students opportunities if they would like to use them to interact with students, you know, in other countries and share work openly and so on. So increasingly it was openness, but openness as a complex phenomena. You know, I laterally, after, you know, my own personal experience in open educational practices and then teaching openly, laterally in the 20-teens, I did a PhD in the area of open educational practices. Yeah. And I often describe, you know, my PhD in one sentence was that, you know, open educational practices are complex, always complex, personal, contextual, and continually negotiated. Mm. So that complexity characterizes them. So yes, it's important that we as courses and as institutions share openly and make sure that we're open, but never require individuals to use open practices, because it is always a personal choice.
Hmm. I'm very intrigued by the thought of what it means to teach as an open education practitioner. I wonder if you can give a bit of a breakdown as to how you approach online pedagogies.
Well, I will say that studying women's studies in the 1990s was a gift at the time that I did it. I did it because I had studied engineering for a number of years and had never gotten the opportunity to study history or philosophy or sociology. And in women's studies, I got to study all of those. So I was introduced in those years to the work of Freire and bell hooks and Cynthia Coburn and many others. And I've always been involved in community education as well. So those are really important in community education. But the notion of critical pedagogy became bedrock to me, you know, not just in community education, but in my work in higher education as well. Mm. So when I first encountered being able to teach and be open online, those were very familiar concepts to me. So, you know, about, again, this notion of voice, welcoming the personal, enabling people to participate at whatever level, you know, they wanted to, and care for the individual, honoring the individual, you know, and not just the text as such, you know, the textbook or the canon. So I suppose that would be the core of my pedagogy.
That sounds brilliant. And of course, the technology has changed considerably as well. So back in the days of COSY, it would have been text conferencing.
Yes, indeed.
Now with Zoom and the like, no doubt there's other practices that you're also able to bring to bear. Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of how your open education practice will have shifted as a result of those technologies?
Yes. I mean, I think there's been a lot that's changed very rapidly since 2020, since the days of COVID. So as I said, in like the 2000s and 2010s, we were inviting students, you know, we knew already had open practices in other parts of their lives, you know, to maybe perhaps even tentatively or then more confidently use those practices as scholars and as soon to be professionals. The narrative in 2020, then it was kind of a real, you know, discontinuity because all of a sudden everyone was teaching online,
yeah,
if not openly. Interestingly enough, I was working in Ireland's National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in 2020. I was the lead for digital and open education on our team. And in about 6 months before COVID hit, we ran something called the Index Survey, the Irish National Digital Experience Survey. And the statistic of all of the questions, the statistics that was most quoted after COVID was that 70% of those who were teaching in higher education had never taught live online.
Wow.
And that was as of November 2019. Yeah. So we had a real benchmark. And then, of course, in March 2020, Ireland went completely online on the 13th of March. 2020, 100% of those who were teaching taught live online. So the scale up, you know, that was done by individual educators, by teaching and learning centers, by our national organization and so many others was just enormous. And many, many different skills were learned. A lot of stress was also experienced, and I think is still being experienced. So I see that online learning has become embedded more thoroughly. People understand the choices, that kind of just assuming that you'll do an hour online lecture live online, which many people might have done in the early stages, that's not, you know, so common practice anymore. Mm-hmm. We have tools we can use, both institutional tools and outside the institution tools. However, I also see an increasing number of challenges as well, which impede progress in open and online education. You know, resources are cut short. The support that's needed for students, staff, and faculty is often not there. And people make the most of what is there, but because of shortages in resources, you know, we don't have often the support that we would want. We need more research. Staff is often precarious. So, you know, what can we ask of staff in terms of professional training, in terms of, you know, meeting with students and so on, if they're not full-time members of staff. So there are a lot of things happening at the same time. I should also mention, you know, local and global problems continue to worsen. Mm. You know, climate change, ecological issues, rising and intersecting forms of inequality and so on. So, you know, it's very difficult. If you just look at online learning in isolation, you can say certain things, but in the big picture, you know, we have a lot of challenges.
Yeah, we certainly do. So I can't help thinking, though, that online education might provide some solution to some of those challenges. Mm-hmm. I'm interested, though, in exploring online and open, so that they're clearly terms which have a particular meaning for you, particularly in your practice.
Yeah.
How can we contrast that with what closed education practice might look like? Is it possible to just explore what openness means in terms of the education movement there?
That's a good question. Of course, the open educational resources definition and movement is probably where to start. And that was, you know, defined, you know, 20 years ago as educational resources that are either in the public domain or licensed, typically with a Creative Commons license, so that they can be found and adapted and used and reused by anyone. So what that means in practice is that if something is an open educational resource, it has an open license on it, and it doesn't necessarily have to be behind, you know, the paywalls of an institution or a library or a journal or so on. Mm. So that's easily understandable when we talk about things like articles and courses and so on. But practices is a bit more nuanced.
Yeah.
Practices, again, I like that term of smudging the boundaries of the higher education institution, inviting students to not just complete assignments that would only be a private transaction between the student and their lecturer, but actually to produce something that they would openly license and, again, to share with communities that are meaningful to them.
Mm.
So, you know, I've done that with students where they developed digital resources for, you know, clubs and societies that they were involved in as students, or, you know, communities outside the institution about music or animals or local history or whatever. And, you know, when students can connect with a personal passion of theirs, you know, quite often it becomes a much richer learning experience. So it's not just about making it open for open sake, but about connecting with, you know, the whole person. Now, of course, when you connect with the whole person, that also brings to mind different issues around privacy, digital identity, and so on. So it's not, you know, it's not just a matter of, hey, here, attach this open license and send it out there. It's a whole learning process around, you know, again, what were called digital literacies, laterally called digital capabilities, thanks to Helen Beetham's work, in which we in the institution help students to understand those issues as part of sharing openly. And that is a life skill. You know, that is something that is an important piece of learning that students will take with them beyond the institution.
So the open education practices actually create open education practitioners, passing it on to the next generation of graduates.
Indeed. And I said for many years that I think as higher education institutions, we're letting students down if we don't help them to develop those skills in an environment where there's so much support and options to, you know, be closed or open or choose avenues in between. That's the place where we can, you know, help students to develop those capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, Catherine, we have now just passed the midpoint of 2024. I'm not sure where the first 6 months have gone, but I'm very interested in your observations about online learning and education right at this moment.
I hoped that in our conversation we might talk about hope, because I definitely do have hope.
Please do.
It was certainly a theme of our book, Higher Education for Good. It's a theme certainly in my work. For me, it's a matter of seeing clear-eyed what is. So seeing inequality, seeing oppressive structures within higher education, even seeing, you know, increasingly embedded neoliberal values, but still believing in the possibility and imperative of better futures. And we'll come around to online, but I saw the author Paul Lynch at a book festival this weekend. He wrote the book called Prophet Song, which won the Booker Prize last year. And briefly, I mean, for anyone who's not familiar with the book, it's about a very tangible and believable Ireland of today descending into autocracy and state violence. And he mentioned that, you know, many people have said to him, is this dystopian? You know, is this really believable? And, you know, he described that, of course, it can happen and does happen anywhere and everywhere. And, you know, his remark was, it has always happened, it is happening, and it will happen. So, and he was just describing in the book how it could happen in Ireland. And in a positive way, I feel that about higher education as well. So I view higher education as central to human rights, human dignity, the development of human capabilities, and that higher education can and must address these issues, even in, you know, the midst of all of the challenges that higher education is facing now. And, you know, I think the focus, and many other people are saying this, not just me, but the focus should increasingly be and clearly be on, you know, the significant issues of our time. So if we're not talking about climate change, you know, in the work that we're doing in, you know, in any faculty, what are we doing? You know, this is the key issue of our time. That's closely linked, of course, with rising inequality, as I said, the whole notion of social cohesion. So we need to just continually and explicitly state and claim the aims of humanizing and increasing access to higher education. And to the extent that online education can enable that, you know, providing equality of opportunity for all, then we should do that. So not being driven by the technology, but by the aims that I just mentioned.
Great. And the hope is that open education or online education will step up to that challenge, be able to make that education accessible, inclusive, to reach out to as many as possible.
Well, again, hearkening back to COVID, you know, anything that any of us understood about inequality before COVID, we understood a lot more after it. You know, we learned how people fell out of the system, how students couldn't continue to study, how different people who were teaching could or could not do their work, given the constraints that they were experiencing in their living situations. So, you know, addressing inequality must be key, and openness is one of the important ways that we can help to address inequality. I believe, you know, both as higher education institutions and others, other state-funded institutions, you know, and the EU, UNESCO, you know, many, many major organizations have also explicitly recognized that.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us a bit about the challenges and how they can be overcome, because I understand too that COVID did bring out the digital divide, something that we were perhaps previously unaware of, but suddenly completely came to the fore when it became obvious that many people couldn't access the online education we were trying to offer, even for free.
Yes.
What are some of the challenges we face, and what are some of the things we might do to overcome them?
There are many things. I mean, in terms of students, you know, students were often at a loss in terms of having, you know, devices, having Wi-Fi, in some countries having electricity. So, you know, at the bottom of the hierarchy of needs, you know, we need to talk about equitable access to, you know, to the digital, you know, if we're going to be involved in online education. So I think some of the places that are leading are places like the University of Cape Town, which, you know, my colleague Laura Chernowich is a professor emerita at the University of Cape Town. In Higher Education for Good, if I can take a slight diversion, we invited scholars from as many areas of the globe as possible to address this notion of, you know, how can we create better futures for higher education? And it's very illuminating because, you know, conversations among and between scholars from different parts of the world, we help one another to understand these issues differently.
Yeah.
So certainly addressing those kind of base level needs. And then when it comes to those who are teaching and supporting students, staff, faculty, how are we equipping staff with structural support and jobs which are not just, you know, 3 month, 6 month, 9 month contracts and so on.
Yeah.
So structural supports for learners, for teachers, before we even start talking about how we design courses and so on. Structural change.
Yeah, so everything around online education. So not, before we even get to the pedagogy, all of that infrastructure, all of those values need to be in place.
Yes.
Yeah. Catherine, the research you'd most like to see. So based on everything you know and have experienced, you open up a journal and the perfect article is there which scratches every itch you've had. What is it about?
First of all, it addresses higher education in terms of the wider issues that I just mentioned, climate change, inequality, research for better futures. It foregrounds the experiences of those who have traditionally been on the margins. So non-traditional higher education students, students altogether, women of color, LGBTQ individuals and communities, scholars from the Global South, as I just mentioned, not as a token, but as central to understanding and addressing the challenges of education today. And also, of course, foregrounding learning and not the technology. We haven't talked about technology very much now, and that's, I'm really pleased about that because, you know, so many journals that we open up now, you know, the people who are designing the technology are the ones who are trying to tell us, you know, what we need. But what we need to talk about are people, communities, learning.
Great. And of course, you haven't even mentioned artificial intelligence, and we're over 20 minutes into the interview, which is wonderful.
Indeed.
So what I'm picking up then is the online part of online education is actually the mechanism for a whole series of values, practices, I'm struggling for the word, but there's a whole set of considerations that actually underpin practice. And the online is almost like the last mile connecting all of those two learners. Am I reading you correctly there?
Yeah, that's a good description, exactly. And so often we want to start there, whereas what we need to be focusing on are, again, the individual's care, support, connection, respect, trust. You know, that's the core. And then the technologies will always be evolving.
Yeah.
So, but if we're clear about those core values, then we can make choices about the technology.
Great. So it's almost like the difference between online education and education that is online. So starting with the education, starting with all of those wonderful things we want to see in our graduates, enriching their lives, helping them to flourish within their own settings. And by the way, we happen to do it using online tools these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you have this experience from the 90s as well. So, you know, you would have been hopefully speaking about those kinds of values. I expect you would, you know, in the 90s, regardless of whether it was cozy or whether we're talking about some kind of social media or mapping software or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I think to some extent, my own context is more vocational. So the actual learning outcomes are pretty much pre-digested. And it's more of a focus on helping learners achieve certain ends rather than seeing themselves as learners differently.
Yes.
That it's more of an implicit part of the practice that I'm a part of, but I can certainly see the value. In fact, we do have these values at the institution I work in, where we do try to encourage learners to become more of who they can be, not just filling their minds with new skills and learning outcomes.
Wonderful.
Catherine, two people you'd recommend as leaders or legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and someone who you think otherwise might have an important perspective to share.
Oh, this was tricky. I mean, there's so many people I could say, and actually a couple of people that I thought of you've already spoken to. So that made my work a little bit easier. So
it's the hardest question.
It's such a hard question. I'm not sure that you've spoken with Helen Beetham, have you?
Oh, I don't think I have, no.
I don't think you have. And I thought of Helen just immediately because Helen is a hugely experienced researcher, educator, activist working in the field of digital education in higher education. So she and a colleague co-edited Rethinking Pedagogy for a Digital Age,
yes,
which is a book you may be familiar with. And I think there are three editions of that from the mid-2000s. So she's been in this space for a very long time. She's done work for JISC in the UK for 2 decades. So, you know, the model of digital literacies that many of us would have, you know, connected with 10, 15 years ago, which evolved into a model called digital capabilities, hugely influential in my work, particularly in the National Forum. And then most recently, she's applied her years of experience and intellect and community work and so on to a Substack called Imperfect Offerings, where she is dealing with issues around artificial intelligence and critical digital education today.
Great.
And I don't know anyone in my spaces in Ireland and the UK who is not reading Helen Beetham's Substack at the moment. She is, you know, she's a wonderful writer and thinker. So I definitely would recommend speaking with Helen.
Mm, brilliant.
So she's influenced my work and many, many people's work considerably. An important perspective, again, there are many people I could choose. I'm going to mention Mpine Meko, who's at UNISA in South Africa. Mpine authored a chapter in Higher Education for Good called Visioning Higher Education Futures for the Common Good. And it's just this wonderful unpicking of what the good is, what's the public good compared to the common good, and so on. A lot of us are wrestling with those issues at the moment. But she's got enormous experience in research in online learning, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. So a really important and eloquent voice.
Absolutely. In fact, I saw Mpina last week or 2 weeks ago in Geneva at the ICD Leadership Summit.
You know her, so.
Yeah, I have interviewed Mpina. She's absolutely wonderful.
So, yes.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for everything you're doing for open education practice and the wonderful scholarship you're bringing to bear. And thank you for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Thank you, Mark. I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much.
You can learn more about Catherine and her work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.